Hello, I'm Kendra.
And I'm August.
And welcome to Book Dumb, the bookcast brought to you by a couple of dummies.
This week, we're doing our second episode of Canonical Favorites, where we're breaking down two pieces of literature from the literary canon to hopefully make them more accessible and interesting to you.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think we've accidentally, and maybe entirely intentionally, chosen a theme for today.
Yes. The theme, devils? Hell?
All of the above.
Perfect. Exactly where we want to be. Because yeah. Didn't you know hell is empty and all the devils are here?
I have maybe a spoiler for you.
That's good for you, actually, since you have the devil fetish.
I do. I'm like really glad.
Bring them to me.
They're all here. Also, myself am hell. Mm-hmm. That's Satan from Paradise Lost.
Beautiful.
Why this is hell and I am out of it. That's from Faustus. Does that make sense? Oh. No, it doesn't.
But no sense to me. In one ear, out the other. Okay, but before we jump into our books, actually we both picked plays. So we have a plays for this week. Tell me what you're reading right now.
I am reading Say Nothing.
Oh.
By someone.
Patrick Raiden O'Keefe.
Thank you. Saving me. I was like, a person did write this, yes.
The most Irish name possible.
Yeah, he's Irish-American, isn't he?
I believe so.
Because and he's like an Irish scholar, mm-hmm. or a scholar of Irish history.
Yes.
And I read it based on August's recommendation, and by golly, she was right.
Mm-hmm. When am I not?
Let's just add that in. It's killing me. It's killing me good to utter those words. And it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It's probably the best audiobook. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm just like on a high.
Well, that narrator.
So good.
That beautiful Irish accent.
Yeah, and I find the troubles in the cause so interesting. Mm-hmm. Which we could have a whole episode about, but I won't because it's such a complex and nuanced issue, and it's a very personal issue for many people. Mm-hmm. And I think if you are even like remotely interested in it, pick up Say Nothing.
Yeah.
Audiobook was great. I'm probably going to buy the physical copy.
Yeah, I feel like I need to have a physical copy of that book because it's just so damn good. And all the information provided, like, not that I wasn't paying attention during the audiobook. I tried my hardest, but I feel like a lot of it went over my head or I just missed out on it entirely.
I agree. Yeah. Well, what are you reading right now?
So I actually just finished listening to the audiobook for Brokeback Mountain by Annie Proulx? Who knows? I can't pronounce anything. But I had never read the short story before. I didn't even know it was a short story. I had only seen the movie, and I love the movie. I listened to the audiobook on Hoopla. It's only an hour long, and fuck, my heart hurt after that. I was also reading, I finished Morris the other day as well, the same day that I listened to the short story. So it was just a day for sad gay men.
Aww.
And you know what? It's beautiful. I love
say,
it.
Like your
kind of my aesthetic, yeah. But it was really good. It was available on Hoopla for free and was only an hour long. As someone who loves the movie, I very much enjoyed the audiobook and I really want to go watch the movie again.
Yeah, I gotta read it. I honestly didn't know until recently that it was a book first. Mm-hmm. Or is it a novella, maybe?
Just short story, short I story. Guess. Yeah, it's in a collection of a number of other short stories by the author, but the short story for it is by itself on Hoopla, so you can listen to it as a standalone text.
Awesome.
Yeah, and it's so good. Highly, highly recommend.
Good to know. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, should we both say what books we're covering? We should let the listener know. There's going to be spoilers in this episode. Kind of hard to break down works from the literary canon without including some spoilers. So, expect that.
And also, I feel like our whole goal with these episodes is to really convince you to read these, mm-hmm. but also to, if you've read them and found them inaccessible, we really want to make them accessible and fun for you. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is kind of giving you some spoilery analysis.
Yes, I'd agree.
Yeah. So tell me about your text first, and then
I'm going to be covering Jean-Paul Sartre's, I say Sartre, I know some people say Sartre.
I grew up
in the United States, Sartre. I'm going to be covering No Exit, which is probably his most famous play, I would mm-hmm. say.
Only one I've read by him,
There's one, I think it's called The Flies, that's in the collection often with No Exit, and it's very good as well. But before we get into discussing No Exit, we're going to discuss your play. Are you ready to go off? Because I know you are.
I'm shaking. I've had cold brew, and this is one of my favorite plays of all time, and I get to, like, nerd out about my favorite period, which is the early modern period. Mm-hmm. So I am stoked, and I'm sorry I'm going to be annoying, but...
Surprise, we're always annoying.
Yeah, I was like, surprise, if you listen to this podcast, you know that.
You already are aware.
And I'm going to be talking about Dr. Houstis. Have you seen that medical show?
Oh my God, with you, Lori? The wow. Talented jazz musician and actor from Veep, you, Lori?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to be talking about this entire episode.
Beautiful.
Notably from the early modern period.
Early modern being what, early 2000s?
Yeah. Like the TikTok generation is like, if you were born. I digress. See, obviously the cold brew has kicked in, folks. I am so sorry, but I will be talking about Dr. Faustus by Christopher Marlowe.
Woohoo!
If you have not heard of this play, that's obviously totally fine. That's what I'm here to do, is let you know it exists. And it is, it was performed for the first time in 1592.
Wow.
Let me double check. I just kind of said that off the top of my head. And yes.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Wasn't Marlowe like buddies with Shakespeare? I know they like work together a little bit, right? Just for context. Or no?
Sorry, the reason I'm hesitating is because yes and no.
Depending on who you're talking to?
Definitely.
Because I had heard that Marlowe wrote the witch's parts in Macbeth.
That's a kind of a rumor. Oh. Or that, because I think they were in contact with one another, and there's a very good chance they were pals. Like,
yeah, be friends with the playwrights of your era.
But there's entirely no evidence of it. I think that... what I read, it's been a few years since I've read, but I know exactly what piece of scholarship you're talking about. It was a couple of scholars, I think they're British scholars, who did see parallels between Marlowe's writing, because the way the witches show up in Macbeth, it's different than Shakespeare's approach to other witches in other plays. I think they compared it to The Tempest. I'm sorry if I'm butchering this, because that's all from like the top of my head.
Okay.
So yeah, I think I'm going to get into a few things about Marlowe's life that are... all a lot of speculation and rumor, but are like really fun to talk about as the person. But the text itself was performed for the first time in 1592. There are two texts that exist. There's the A text and the B text. I'll be working with the A text, not because one is more valuable than the other. It's what I prefer. The A text in the ending, they have different endings, and there's some controversy. I would not say controversy, maybe debate over which one is true to Marlowe's vision.
Mm.
I'm going to take a leap and say, I think A text, in my opinion, because in the A text, Faustus does not repent.
Ah.
In the B text, he does.
Ugh.
So being the Church of England, very Protestant, I'll get into the different sectors of Protestantism later, but the ability to repent is like kind of the big issue of this text.
Okay.
So for more context, this is clearly an Elizabethan tragedy, 1592, that's around the time. And it's based on the German stories about the titular character Faustus. So that's like the tragical history of the life and death of Dr. Faustus.
Mm-hmm.
And he's this mythic figure. And I don't exactly remember when the original text came out. I know it's a medieval text.
Okay.
So it would be before this time, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And Faust, you might have heard, like, Faustian bargains. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's the origin of this.
It's Addie LaRue. We've talked about it before.
And so in this German story, he's this mythological erudite who is obnoxiously dissatisfied with all of his success. It's this story of ambition and not being able to be satisfied with everything you've accomplished and always reaching for more. And so he's so dissatisfied, he tries to sell his soul. Well, he doesn't try. He accomplishes that.
Nice.
He sells his soul to the devil, and many different interpretations, but that's basically the thing of it. And yeah, lost my train of thought because I was rambling, so I'm going to find the notes where I am now.
Scroll, scroll, scroll.
Scroll, scroll, scroll. Okay. So, as I said, he is an academic. He has a bunch of other scholars following him. In the first act, the chorus likens him to Icarus, and... we know how things went for Icarus, so not well, folks. I think so. That's why I don't feel too bad about giving spoilers, because I'm kind of like, it's kind of like in Romeo and Juliet, where the chorus from the beginning tells you exactly what's going to happen.
Mm.
So, sorry.
Yeah.
Spoiler: things don't go well for Faustus.
Oh, rats!
Rats!
Really, you can't get away with selling your soul and having a good time?
Ask Addie.
Well, when I sell my soul, I'm fully planning on having a good time. So, Faust, you did one way. I chose another.
Entirely. That's exactly what I'm going for. Mm-hmm. So Faustus in this play has mastered the major branches of learning, which he annoyingly has to say in Latin. Like, he can't just say, like, I'm good at this.
Well, because he mastered learning, he has to be a show-off, too. Oh, did he master the ability to show off?
Clearly, but you know what he did not master?
What?
The ability to think critically about the decisions he makes. So
I mean, that is a hard one.
Yeah,
I'll give it to him.
Learning. And those branches are, at this time, like, the major branches of learning if you're going to go to school. Logic, which, what? Law, medicine, and divinity. So if you were a man of reasonable means, you would go to school and take on one of those, or both, or all. And since he has mastered them, he feels he's above human knowledge. It is unusual for one person to master all four, which, God.
All right. Maybe he was just a rich bitch and had the time to.
Clearly, yeah. Yeah, definitely, especially for this time. And he kind of is just, like, over it. He's, like, kind of a dick where he's, like, I'm so smart. I know all this stuff. Other humans are dumb. I'm clearly the best one. And then he says, okay, Sarah, Sarah. Okay, Sarah, Sarah. Uh-huh. And that means whatever will be, if you've heard the Frank Sinatra song. And that's an important line, in my opinion, because this is a little hint for my discussion later. It's a popular Calvinist phrase.
We're going to get into Calvinism?
Briefly. I don't want to bore you. Calvinism is, like, one of my, like, pet interests, but I think it's so fascinating in this period. But Calvinism, in my opinion, and anti-Calvinism is one of the many tensions at play in this play. Okay. So enter Mephistopheles.
Our boy.
Our boy.
We love to see him.
We stand, honestly. Truly stand. Faustus's dumbass was trying to summon Lucifer, as some of you might know him as Luke. Just kidding. My boy. No, this one sounds hot. But just as toxic. Was that toxic? Yeah. We are in fine form today.
We've got a lot of coffee.
So Mephistopheles shows up, because, as I said, Faustus is an idiot, a smart idiot. And long story short, Faustus is tricked into thinking that since he summoned the devil, he controls the devil, who is not Lucifer. Mephistopheles, who is, like, a minor devil, still has some powers. And so Faust thinks that if he sells his soul to Satan, Lucifer in this case, then he's in charge of, like, the devil's...
What a dumb bitch.
Literally, like, he's so arrogant that he's like...
Wait, would you say that he is book dumb?
Honestly, I would not even insult us in that way. I feel like if we summon the devil, we would know, oh, well, I'm not calling the shots here.
Yeah, you're in charge.
Yeah, which is... So, clearly that's not true, and it's kind of the big part of the climax is him realizing that. And a bunch of things happen. I'm just skimming over major summaries. And they travel the world. Faustus has this power to, like, see everything. He fucks Helen of Troy.
So cool. That's what I see.
Yeah, literally. And, like, okay, so one of his powers is, like, he wants to fuck the most beautiful woman in the world. Sorry, Mom, Dad. I know you're listening. And he, okay, this is the famous line, because she walks out. She's gorgeous, stunning, as we know. And he goes, is this the face that launched 1,000 ships? So if you've ever heard that phrase before, that's from this play.
I'm pretty sure it was in Grecian mythology too, right?
The face that launched 1,000 ships, but I think, sorry, my point was, like...
That line originated from Faustus?
I thought so. Maybe I'm wrong now.
Oh, who knows? There's a book about Helen out now, apparently.
Okay, maybe in. I honestly thought that that's where it originated from.
It could be. For some reason, I think it might be in the Odyssey.
I would trust you on that.
Don't trust me. Don't trust a hoe. Didn't you learn anything from 303?
Okay, all right.
Come on.
Send some fan mail in or hate mail. We'll find out. Or I'll just Google it later and post a redaction. But I don't know. So that, yeah, I associate that line with this play. And eventually the time of reckoning comes. Faustus's time is up. As always, when you sell your soul, unless you're Addie, there is a time limit. I can't stop thinking of her.
She's on your mind.
On my mind all the time.
Those seven stars just can't get out of your head. Which is funny, because she's forgettable. So
knee slappers all around.
Yeah.
Yeah, so since I'm working with the A-text, Faust is dragged off to hell by the demons, and he's screaming out for help. Significantly, he doesn't repent. He doesn't call to God, mm-hmm. which some readings of the text would say that he might have been saved. Mm-hmm. Some would say that it doesn't matter because he was destined to be damned. And that's where Calvinism and anti-Calvinism come in. But before I get that, I'm just teasing Calvinism the whole time. I want to talk about Marlowe because...
Okay. He had a very fun time. Question mark?
Marlowe, lots of controversy mm-hmm. surrounding our boy. An atheist? A Catholic? A secret spy? A homosexual? No idea.
I want, of course, the motto, be gay, do crime. I hope that that is true for Marlowe.
That... He originated that term.
Just kidding. Yes! In my heart, it is true.
So yeah, there is so much speculation to this day about his religious beliefs. A lot of people interpret him as an atheist and that his atheism is kind of on display in this play. Mm. Some say he was a spy for the Catholics because this is... You're like,
so not even a cool spy? Maybe a cool spy.
Even being a spy for the Catholics would not necessarily mean that he's a spy for the religion. It would mean like he's just against the Church of England.
Oh, okay.
So when he eventually
dies, I'm just imagining like modern Catholics as a spy going around.
Just like similarly to like the Troubles in Ireland, it was as much a political identity as it is a religious identity. But obviously, no, I have no idea if that's what he was. A lot of rumors surrounding... One being that he was gay, there was actually writing about him, like, having sexual relationships with men, which we stan. Yeah, of course.
Big fan.
But that's often used to slander and undermine men. Like, it wasn't necessarily rooted in, I guess what I'm trying to say is that those were usually tied to sexual acts rather than sexual orientation or sexuality, and there was really no concept of what we have, and so he might have been queer. We have no idea, but the labels put onto him were probably... coming from a place to like slander him.
Okay.
Which sucks.
Yeah.
But I hope either way he was happy, but no matter what, he pissed a lot of people off in his day and it makes him fun to read now.
A relatable king.
Yeah. Exactly. So, just like the controversial man, controversial play. People were really upset.
Wait, can you tell me about Marlowe's death really quick?
Yeah, I can't. Okay.
How can you bring up Marlowe and not talk about this?
Good point. Yeah. Good point. Okay, so if you've heard of Marlowe's death, you might have heard that he was stabbed in the eye with his pencil, which is not entirely true.
God damn it.
Which is more fun.
Yeah.
He was stabbed in the eye, though there actually are no witnesses saying it was a pencil. Mm-hmm. I think that was a rumor because, like, his writing was so controversial and upset a lot of people. That they're like, oh, his writing killed him, so, like...
Love.
Yeah, so, like, the metaphor of the death really stuck to his reputation, but actually, in preparation for this episode, I did look up kind of, like, the case around his death and the writing, and he was stabbed in the eye at a bar. Most witnesses did report it was a dagger. After his death, lots wrote that it was either a lover's quarrel, but the words they used were lewd love, so assuming it was... two men fighting because they were in love. Again, just like used to make implications about his sexuality. Some report that it was because he was an atheist and so he had pissed enough people off and religion was, like I said, a political identity, but also you can't go against the norm in that time. And so he was murdered for that. My favorite one, some report that he was ordered to be assassinated by Queen Elizabeth because he was a spy. No evidence really for either. I do wish one of these was the cases, but right now the general consensus is that there was a dispute over the bill in a bar. So he died in a bar fight.
Still cool.
Still cool.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not cool, but like cool, you know?
Yeah.
Getting stabbed in the eye, just what a way to go. Makes me think of, this didn't kill him, but Oedipus, when he stabs himself in the eyes to remove his ability of sight, that's... blah, blah, blah. To when Oedipus stabs himself in the eyes after figuring out what he has done. It just makes me think of that. So, fun.
Yeah, definitely done by someone else, I think. But knowing Marlowe, honestly, anything's possible.
Just some good eye-stabbing action. What the people want, what they get.
Exactly. So I could get into the nitty-gritty.
Please do.
So why does this text matter? That's why have I brought it up? Why do I think you should read it? I think it's valuable... partly because it mixes traditional comic and tragic elements of the play. It's really fucking funny, I think. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine how funny it would be to see.
Yeah.
But also it did upset a lot of people when it came out because there were actual demons on display, and that was unconventional.
But we love to see
it. We love it. My favorite part is when, like, the seven sins are personified, and they come out, you guys, they come out onto the stage, and they're this ridiculous manifestation of the sin. Like, there's lechery, and it's, like, this woman who was probably played by a man at that time who was just, like, super, like, sexual and licking everything, and just, like, yeah, August is, like, in love. And then there's just, like, really fun personifications of the seven sins. Mm-hmm. And I also think this play does a great job of showing the connection between the world of religion, but also magic and science, and how those are often set as, I think, as contrasts, but he blends them here in, like, a really interesting way. There's also an examination between knowledge and power. His knowledge is literally represented as power. And yeah, and I think the biggest message is the bitter fruits of ambition. And are they worth it? So I'm going to get into Protestantism briefly.
Okay.
So Calvinism, which I did mention quite a bit. So Calvinism. Calvinism was a sector of Protestantism that kind of developed post-Reformation. It's a really complicated issue. I'm going to try to do it justice because, as I mentioned in the Hamlet episode, I'm fascinated by Reformation literature and, like, and its effects on peoples and the Revolution and the British Civil War. So after the Reformation, 1534, Europe, not just England, was kind of re-examining its relationships to these structural power systems. And so there were a lot of people who were, I won't say being introspective for the first time, I think that's unfair, but really negotiating their identity and their relationships to state, but also their relationships to other humans. And so that's why you do kind of start to see queer literature coming out. And yeah, it's great. And so Calvinism kind of developed because while people were trying to understand what the Church of England really stood for, they were looking closer at doctrine and really, really considering predestination, which means that, like, you have a fixed fate. And so Calvinism was the sector of Protestantism that believed in the fixed fate. And anti-Calvinism kind of surfaced as response to that, not necessarily tied into, like, Lutheranism. Anti-Calvinism believed in free will, inherently free will. So those are the two things you're going to see at play in Faustus, because at the end, when he's being dragged to hell, there are a lot of scholars and just readers in general who think if he just says, spare me God, because he says, spare me Lucifer, he could have been saved. And so it's this major question of, I think, not just tied down to religion, but, like, how much control do we have over our own lives, really? I think in the context of religion in this space, it's, is there free will? What is the scope of their God's forgiveness? Like, do you get to a point where you're unsavable? So I think that's why it's one reason it's very valuable. I definitely think it portrays hell as a state of mind as well, which is one of my favorite things to explore as a reader. It's phenomenal. I know the play is based on the German book, which came out in 1587, not medieval, so redact. But Marlowe makes Faustus way more sympathetic. Way more sympathetic. I think this is a significant text if you're even remotely interested in Elizabethan literature, or even just general early modern literature.
Even as somebody, I'm not interested in those time periods at all. We read Dr. Faustus together after reading Paradise Lost, and then we read No Exit after it. But as someone who's not into that type of literature, I loved reading this play, mainly because I'm really interested in, like, depiction of hell over time. The depiction of hell, I think, is very, very interesting. Also, just to have an idea, not that this is, like, the original Faustian bargain, as you were just saying, there's the German text that predates it, but as somebody who's very interested in Faustian bargains and just deals with devils of all sorts, very entertaining to read. And also funny. I agree with you saying that it's funny.
Yeah, when I read it, I remember, like, chuckling, because part of it's ridiculous, but
I have a memory of reading this text for that class that we were in, and I was at one of our favorite bakeries in San Francisco, Thoroughbred, is when things were open a couple years ago, pre-COVID times, and I remember sitting on their back patio, like, actually laughing out loud while reading it, and being like, oh, I'm sitting here by myself, I probably shouldn't be laughing out loud.
But you're fine.
Yeah.
It's a very funny text. I also think all of these, you know, these tensions that are established in the play are intentionally unresolved. I personally believe you're not going to finish this book and come out thinking exactly one way wins. I think Marlowe's really good about having these tensions push and pull against one another and never really establish an equilibrium. So these tensions, which are like, as I said, Calvinism versus anti-Calvinism, comic versus tragic, religion versus magic, determinism versus voluntarism, neither is resolved because I think Marlowe's trying to be like, there is no like correct way. Yeah. There is no yes, there is no to either of these. Especially he was very publicly critical of Orthodox religion, whether he was religious or not, or he was an atheist. He did not like dogma. He thought it was unfair. And I think this play kind of demonstrates the limitations of Orthodoxy and interpreting scripture as scripture, like as directly and literally as possible. And I think it can really impose some like major epistemological questions that we still have to this day. I love it. I love it.
A beautiful play.
Beautiful play.
Yeah. Anytime someone sells their soul, I'm here for it. I love it. I want to see it. I want to be it. Question mark.
And it's so short. It's 60 pages.
Yeah. A very, very enjoyable read.
Yeah.
Wow. So if you had to pick an actor to play Dr. Faustus in a movie, who would it be? And who would play Mephistopheles?
God, I really think Mephistopheles could be played by Helena Bonham Carter because, I mean, she can play anything, but I would really like to see a woman play Mephistopheles. And I think she has this, like, really, I don't know, she plays evil characters in a really so spirited way.
Yeah.
Faust is tough. I think Faust, I should have been prepared for this question. I really should have. I really hate this guy, but, like, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, yeah. He would do a good job for it.
Just because, I mean...
He does a great job for any English play, really.
Yeah.
From I've seen.
I really... Yeah, I hate that, but he would it would suit him, I think.
Yeah. If I had to cast Faustus, I would probably do... Oh, I don't even know. Maybe Carey Mulligan would be cool. And then for Mephistopheles, it would be cool to have maybe, like, Olivia Colman...
Ooh.
I feel like that would be neat.
I like that.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I really like Dr. Faustus, and I'm glad that you talked about it today when we were texting about this earlier, and you were like, oh, I can do Faust. I was like, please.
Well, I was inspired by your pick. If you want to get into it now.
Sure. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre, and this is a play that came out in May 1944 in Paris, France. And it's about hell and what hell is, and surprise, it's other people. That's the big thing from this. Joseph Garcon?
I'm not sure.
I'm just going to call him Joseph.
Joe.
Good old Joe. But he's not that good. He realizes this at a moment in the play, just the idea that hell can be brought about from interacting with other people and their influences on you as a person. So just some quick background on what No Exit is about. It is a single act play with multiple scenes in it, I believe four or five, I could be wrong, that focuses on three characters and three characters only in a single room in hell. So the characters are Joseph Garcin, who was a journalist during his lifetime and is just a dickhead. He also cheats on his wife and thinks a lot of things that are wrong. And then there's Inez Serrano, who is really, I personally write like her because she is often described as, not in these words exactly, but basically as a cold, animalistic lesbian. And I kind of woman. So I love Inez. She's probably my favorite character from this play, even though I'm going to let everyone know right now, all three are terrible people in different ways. They are in hell for a reason. And then there's Estelle Rigaud. I don't know. I don't speak French. I took 3 years of it in high school. But Estelle, who is a young, beautiful blonde. And so these three individuals are placed in a room in hell by a valet who's only there literally to bring them into the rooms. Joseph and Estelle think that it's wrong. They feel like they should not be in hell. They feel like they were brought here on some sort of mistake, that they're actually very good people and they shouldn't be punished for their actions on earth. While Inez is like, fuck you, idiots. Of course we all deserve to be here. Like, can you look at yourself honestly and have a moment of true reflection, which is a crucial element of this play. Looking in at oneself and recognizing what one has done wrong, what one should have done instead of what they ultimately chose. That is a major element of here, and it really ties in with this idea of other people can take your power away, but you always have the freedom of choice. Mm-hmm. No matter what, you also have the freedom of thought. So even if you can't really act on your decisions, like, I think Estelle does something very wrong, but, like, looking at it from a modern lens, we can maybe not justify it entirely, but understand where she's coming from with what she did, even though it is very, very fucked up. But this whole idea of freedom of choice, which is Sartrean existentialism, so much fun. So they're in this room. Inez is like, hey, let's have a moment of self-reflection. And then they realize, like, oh, Joseph is not in here because he was a pacifist. He's in here because he was horrible to his wife while he was alive and mistreated her, cheated on her, and also was just a general dickhead in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. Inez was sent to hell because she's a lesbian who had an affair with her family member's wife. I think it might be her brother's. I could be wrong on there. But also, she is just a very cold-hearted and mean person. Like, she is genuinely, like, an asshole about a lot of things. Personally, I like that because I love an asshole character. But would I want to be around her in real life? No fucking way.
Would you want to be stuck with her for eternity?
No, I wouldn't want to be stuck with any of these people for eternity. Estelle was a young woman who had an affair. She's described as beautiful throughout. There's an incredible focus on her physical appearance. More than any of the characters, and she had a baby through this affair in which she killed in order to hide the affair, even though, you know, pregnancy is 9 months, it's kind of hard to hide, but she killed this child and does regret it. We can get into options for women in France in 1944. If they had a baby and didn't have the means or want to raise it, there's a very inaccessibility of abortion, birth control, a variety of other factors, and that's something we can get into later. But yeah, those are the three characters. And so at a certain point, they do realize, like, they do have to reflect and be honest with each other. And they begin speaking what they think that they have done wrong to each other after driving each other fucking crazy for the amount of time that they've been in this room together. And we have really no way of knowing how long they've ultimately been in this room together. There's no way to measure time. Also, this room is in hell, and it's just an apartment that has Second Empire furniture. They enter this knowing that it's hell. They think there's gonna be medieval torture devices, maybe a devil with one of those three stick things. What are they called?
Pitchfork?
Pitchfork, yeah. Devil with a pitchfork, stuff like that. No, it's just an apartment, but it does get hotter over time as tensions flare. So all of them realize that they have to reflect on their past, particularly back at moments of regret, moments that ultimately brought them to the place that they're at today. So this whole idea of freedom of choice continues into their evaluation of their lives after they have died. So looking back at the past is an own personal type of hell. This is something that one does internally here in the play, but also all together because they share what they're learning for each other, and they also play off of each other in order to make everybody more miserable. There's something really important to note here. Nothing can happen without influencing everything else within this room. So whenever a character has a reaction to something that they did during their lifetime, everyone's going to react to it. So, like, one specific example is Estelle is very focused on physical beauty, and there are no mirrors in this room. She cannot look at herself. So you must rely on the other people there in order to define you, which is something that's for physical, but also internal aspects of one's character. And so Estelle would really like to have a mirror to look on to check her makeup. She's just so, like, out of everybody, their most attention to physicality is given to her because she is shown to be a narcissistic person in certain aspects of her life. Also, another aspect of body that's focused on a lot is Joseph's mouth. He was a journalist during his lifetime, so speech is very important, and the interpretation of speech is very important, whether it's the written word or the verbal word. And so Estelle, wanting to look at herself, making sure that she was put together, no mirror to look at, turns to Inez, who says that she could be her mirror for her and to tell her all the beautiful things about herself. But Estelle says no, because Inez has already shown to be a very cold and callous person, much like she was when she was alive. So she turns to Joseph and begins to attempt to seduce him. He at first is like, nah, from what I remember, I could be wrong. It's been a little while since I've read this. And then they eventually, you know, give in to temptation and start to hook up. And Inez is like, hey, just so you know, while you're doing this, I'm still going to be right here. I'm going to be looking at you. I'm here. I'm going to be judging you. Mm-hmm. So that judgment placed upon both of them is another way of showing how others can create hell in the situation in which you're in. They're all continuously making this place hellish for all three. So that is something fun in there. So, like, I know all of us have, before COVID, been at a party or have gone out with a group of friends, and you're like, oh, these people, I love them, but I really do not want to be right now. This is kind of hellish. And oh boy, that's this play. So three people in a room invoking feelings of true despair can be hell for people. And honestly, if I was in a room with people like Joseph, Inez, or Estelle, it would be hell. I would not want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Sartre plays with religious notions of heaven and hell throughout No Exit. The big one that started from the very beginning is hell is above the earth. It is above the land of the living, when typically we see hell as being below.
Mm-hmm.
So hell is above. It's where you look up. So if people, you know, people look up when they're praying, you're actually praying to hell in Sartre's world. I just love that playing with, like, or that upsetting of stereotyped religious notions, I feel like, is very typical of Sartre. And I just love it a lot. Also, don't at me if it's Sartre. I'm American. I'm not French. Let me live my life. Also, something that I find very interesting is hell as a single room with nothing outside of it. Of course, the three characters are brought in by the valet, so there's some way for them to enter. But even later, when the door to the apartment, which they previously thought was locked and then they were unable to leave, they're able to open it. Joseph opens it, and there's nothing outside. They could leave, but that nothingness is very overwhelming, and it makes hell even more claustrophobic. And earlier I used the word icky to describe it, so I'm going to continue with that. So there is nothing outside of this room for them. So they are trapped in this place that makes them miserable, but being miserable is better than nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of neat.
Also, sheltering in place.
Yeah, relatable. Yeah, seriously, if someone had a studio apartment and they're sharing it with two roommates, that's what this play is.
What a nightmare.
Oh, someone should do this with their roommates as like a COVID play.
I think it would bring some things to the surface.
You never wash your dishes.
Exactly.
You never sweep. One thing that I think is particularly well done here, and it's something that I really love in all literature, even outside of this period of French literature in the 40s, is the need for others in order to define oneself. That's shown literally here through there being no mirrors, no way of looking at one's reflection in anything, relying on another being to literally interpret you as an individual. And that's both physically and emotionally and mentally here. So just like getting past like the presentation of oneself to what one truly is. Presentation is also a crucial element of this text. So I think it's kind of fun. So all these actors are playing their actual role, their characters, whether they're Joseph, Inez, or Estelle, but all these characters are also playing the role of the person that they portray themselves to be in everyday life. So we can go to Freud or Jung here and look at the idea that no matter what, you are always putting on a performance. It is very, very difficult for one to be a true, authentic self and portray that to other people out in the world. So we are all constantly playing a role. You can argue with that. You can agree with that. I don't give a fuck. But yeah, so I think that people are always playing a role. You change yourself depending on what the situation you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully people are authentic most of the times, but I know everyone, like you go into class and you're like, I'm going to portray the confident version of myself. Or you go on a date and you're like, I'm going to portray the sexy version of myself.
Yeah.
Like, you're always putting on a role. And that's very much true for these three characters as well. So there's actors playing a role who are people who are very obviously playing a role and playing different roles throughout the text, depending on where they are in their self-reflection.
Mm-hmm. And there's a degree of authenticity in performing different identities.
Yeah, because just because they're different identities doesn't mean that they're not your own.
Yeah. It is natural, I think, when you go into different spaces to turn on one thing.
Multifaceted self. Right?
Wow, yeah.
Wow. This play, much like it seems, well, maybe not a lot like Faustus, but it doesn't seem like there's any room for salvation for these three people within the text. I was wondering what you make of that in comparison to Faust, where there is the possibility that he is able to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this idea that these three people are eternally damned with no chance? What would Marlowe say to that?
Marlo would present both options and give no answers. My interpretation is there is no option for them because, yeah. I don't mean like because they're destined to be damned. I think the way I read the play is who their inherent selves are the perfect torture devices for each other, mm-hmm. and they bring out the worst in each other,
yes.
and it just kind of exacerbates the traits in them that are, that put them there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it reminds me kind of the Good Place.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So if you've seen The Good Place, I'm not going to say anything else,
mm-hmm.
but there's a reason those people are together.
Mm-hmm.
Same reason here.
This book is why I watched The Good Place.
So
little shout out there, specifically Ted Danson in that show. Love him. Oh. And Jason.
Oh, Jason.
Okay. But yeah, there's really no chance at salvation here. As you were saying, everybody is there to drive the other two completely insane. Inez does that from being very blatant with her anger, with her evaluation of herself and forcing the others or wanting the others to be true about what they have done to get themselves here in this single room of hell. Joseph is just flat out denying that he's a bad person. He is a pacifist. He worked for a newspaper that was very anti-war, which is an honorable thing, I would say. Being a pacifist is a good thing. But he also was a complete dickhead.
I was going to say, I was like, yeah, he did some shitty things.
Yeah, it's multiple aspects of oneself. You can do something good and then still be a shitty person by being shitty to the people in your life, which mm-hmm. he did. Estelle, she murdered a child. We could talk about different things that she could have done with the child after being born. She could have left it somewhere, given it away. It doesn't seem like there was any possibility of her raising it. I mean, it is a hard situation for a woman of this time period to have an unwanted baby. So, of course, that's something we should consider when evaluating her character. But also,
she
murdered a baby.
Well, even then, I think I felt like her choice to murder the child was just kind of emblematic of how, like, selfish and vapid she was.
Yeah, it's rooted in her, like, promoting her self-image and still, like, she very much has an ego, and having a child would destroy that ego.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's, as I've said, very, very focused on beauty and physicality in this text. If you look up anything about it online, while Joseph and Inez are described for their professions, what they did on earth and how they're acting in hell. A lot of times, and I have a problem with this, Estelle is described as a young, beautiful blonde.
Mm-hmm.
People can be beautiful and still do horrible things. Maybe we shouldn't have surface level descriptions of young women, because she's also younger than mm-hmm. these two as well. So she has that naivete that the other two don't necessarily have, or it's much more obvious than the other two characters.
Mm-hmm. I find Inez to be the most sympathetic, because yeah. I'm like, of course you'd be a dick when you live in a homophobic society
yeah.
and everyone's shitty to you.
I cannot even imagine being in a reality where you're going to be criminalized for your sexual orientation and sexual identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely find her to be the most sympathetic, and also I just love a mean lesbian.
I also kind of love that, like you were describing, it's Second Empire furniture and decorations everywhere, mm-hmm. and I kind of felt like that was, like, a snide little slight to that design.
Like, starts like, I don't like that design, he's let's like, just shit talk it.
He's like, if I was designing hell, what kind of furniture?
He's like, Simone de Beauvoir, what should I design hell to be? She's like, I don't care, men are hell.
Well,
Simone de Beauvoir, also a problematic fave.
Yeah, definitely.
The Second Sex is really good. Specifically, she has a chapter on D.H. Lawrence. It's cool. Highly yes. recommend that
Still
bit.
Still very dated.
Yes.
But good foundational
very much,
feminist text.
Yeah. Very much outdated. We can go to modern feminism from Simone de Beauvoir, but still an important feminist figure who just happened to be in a relationship with Sartre. I don't know if they were together at this time. Who knows? I don't care. Yeah, this is just a really interesting play. It's incredibly short, much like Dr. Faustus. You can definitely read this in under an hour, I would say. It's very important for literary history. I mean, Sartian existentialism has had an impact on pretty much all literature, I would say, since its original publication and its original performance. What Sartre did for French theater, I would say, is comparable to what Marlowe was doing for English theater at this time, just mm-hmm. expanding to different notions outside of specific religious or what would the word be for, like, the queen? Governmental?
Regency?
Yeah.
It is government, though.
Yeah. So, like, looking at things from a different perspective than what's seen in other playwrights who are focused on government, specific religion, stuff like that. And also, like, who does not want to read about hell being a single room apartment with three people trapped inside? Maybe it's a little too close to home for some of us during COVID, but I find this play to be incredibly funny at times. I think anything that's existentialist has humor rooted in there, very dark humor, which is very up my alley. And it's also just a really great way to evaluate character without much distraction, because they are just three people in a room together driving each other crazy, bringing out the actual worst of themselves to each other. And I think what's better than three people going absolutely mad, driving each other mad as well? Just three nuts hanging out. not that they're nuts, but, you know, just
they
three.
They drive each other nuts?
They drive each other nuts. Just three people who do not want to be there, two of them do not think that they should be there, and I don't think they ever reconcile with the fact that they are dead, that they are in hell. Just driving each other crazy, and I think that is just so fun.
Mm-hmm.
Would I want to be in their place? No. But do I want to read about it?
Yes. I'm with you 100%. Yeah. This is not usually my cup of tea, this type, this era, this style of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, contrary to belief, because I've just covered two plays nearly back to back, I don't enjoy reading plays usually.
Mm.
Love No Exit, one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah. Thinking about it, I'm not a big play person either, but I think all my favorite plays are by French playwrights.
Ooh.
Yeah, because I love Yasmina Reza is a modern playwright. She has a play called The God of Carnage, and also Art, and those are two phenomenal plays. Mm-hmm. More recent, very well done, very existentialist like Sartre, so maybe I just like some sad Parisian theater.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the case.
But yeah, they do existentialism particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I like that we paired these together, because I think they're texts that go phenomenally side by side.
Yeah.
I think you can do a really interesting comparison between the two, despite there being 400 years between them.
I mean, the depiction of the anxiety of choice, the anxiety of life, really, and both of them, not that it's portrayed in similar ways, but definitely bring up similar issues of how one decides to live and what they do while alive.
And hell as being physical and non-physical spaces.
Yeah.
And
personalized to the individual.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It's so interesting. I love both these plays. I think they should be taught side by side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we had them taught side by side, and I'm glad for that.
Yeah.
So can I tell you who I want each of them to be played by in a movie?
You read my mind. Did you plan this out? I need to know.
No, I didn't. Okay. I should do that now. Okay, Joseph is going to be Mads Mikkelsen, I believe his name is. He's in Hannibal and also, The Hunt, which is the saddest movie I've ever seen. By far, don't watch that if you want to have a good day. Inez, I think I would have her played by, I'm just going to say Olivia Colman, because I'm in an Olivia Colman mood. Or, I'm changing it, Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Oh.
Yes. Phoebe Waller-Bridge as Inez, Mads Mikkelsen as Joseph, and Estelle.
Can I make
yes.
one? I have Tessa Thompson on my mind.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that would be great. I was thinking of also from Westworld.
Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah. Can I change my answer for Joseph for a possible one?
Absolutely not.
Well, if it's not going to be Mads, I'm going to say Lakeith Stanfield, just because I'm having a moment with him right now.
Judas and the Black Messiah.
I'm so excited for that. And also just like everything I've seen him in. Specifically Uncut Gems.
He's so good. I love him.
He is such a talented actor. And you know what? Lakeith deserves all the hype. I am so, just imagine him as Joseph in this.
Yeah, I would be really into that.
Oh, okay. Now I'm just thinking of other casting people. There's that guy from season 3 of Westworld who's also in Lahane and Black Swan.
Ooh.
The rich bitch of season 3 of Westworld.
I know, I'm trying to.
He has the little circle thing.
Yeah, he's like a French actor, but I can't remember his name.
He would also be great in this.
You know who else would be great? Sorry, no, we're just going off about who else would be great. Oscar Wilde.
Oh my god!
Oscar Wilde? Oh my god, I did it again. Isaac.
Oscar Isaac? I'm just imagining Oscar Wilde, though, as he makes a little cameo.
We're just going to make a separate podcast where we just recast people.
Yeah, so I guess that's our casting.
Yeah.
A variety of peoples.
Very cool. Yeah, let us know what you think.
Yeah. Is hell other people, or is it the individual?
Myself, I'm hell. Why, this is hell, nor am I out of it. That's from Faustus. because I don't hell have, is surrounding us at all times.
Hell is other people.
Yes, it is. I can say it now that I'm in this room with you. Yeah. It is for sure other people.
God, Kendra is my personal hell.
That's my goal.
But not actually my personal hell, because Kendra is hell for all people.
Honestly, a compliment. Surrounded by devils.
Yeah. Oof. Oh, your place Oof. To be. Hell is empty. All the devils are here.
So much fun. I love devil-themed, hell-themed episodes.
Yes, we love to talk about it. But ending this hell discussion, I'm sorry. Yes,
that's okay.
What are we talking about next week?
Next, we're going to give another list episode of our favorite audiobooks. Woohoo! We're big fans of audiobooks. I think
big fans.
Half of the books I read each year are audiobooks.
Yes. And just for resources, we use Hoopla and Libby, which are both available for free if you have a library card here in the United States.
At least where we live right now. I think other cities might have the same thing. You can sign up for a library card online. Mm-hmm. Free. Promise you it's super easy. It takes 5 minutes.
Yes. If that even.
Yeah.
It's also great. And maybe you'll get a physical library card. Mine's really cute. It has a cat drawn on it. Mm-hmm. And it says read.
I'm jealous. Yeah. I don't have a physical.
Well, I'm just better than you. Just
okay,
kidding.
I'm canceling.
You don't need a physical. Do you know having fun is not hard if you have a library card?
If you could see my face.
Did you not love Arthur as a child?
I love Arthur.
Okay. I was about to be like, I'm about to throw hands. You do the little.
Yes. Okay, so tune in next week for audiobook recommendations. Mm-hmm. We're also going to, I think, give some tips on like how to get into audiobooks. It did take me a second, I think.
Yeah. And we'll maybe share some stories about fun times we had listening to audiobooks. Who knows? That's in the future.
So you know what to do. Find us on Instagram, Book Dump Podcast. But before you do that, since you're already listening wherever you're listening, make sure you either follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And it would be so great if you could leave us a written review, give some honest feedback. 5-star would be fantastic because that's how we get noticed by other people. Mm-hmm. But give your honest opinion.
Yeah. And if you don't want to leave us a review for whatever reason, feel free to message us on Instagram. You can find us at Book Dump Podcast. You can also find my personal Instagram, me, August, at Iggy Poop.
And me, Kendra, at Kendra Lapp.
Yeah. So send us your thoughts. We'd love to hear them.
All right. We hope you have a great day.
Yeah. Bye.